I want to call this hearing to order, and I want to welcome today's witnesses. I want to warn them at the outset, we are finishing up one vote. We'll have another one. We're going to work through that process, but if people are slipping in and out, I think you understand. Our witnesses today are Avril Haines, the Director of National Intelligence, Jen Easterly, Director of Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, and Lisa Knapp, Executive Assistant Director of the National Security Branch at the FBI. Welcome to all of you. Today's hearing builds on this committee's bipartisan efforts since 2016 to educate the public on the intentions of foreign adversaries seeking to undermine the integrity of our democratic systems and to ensure that U.S. government is postured to protect our elections from those foreign threats. A broad interagency task force is tasked with protecting from two forms of election interference we've seen since 2016. Interference efforts, often cyber-enabled, that target election infrastructure, and separately, influence efforts that seek to affect elections through covert or other illegal tactics. Since 2016, we have held both open and closed hearings ahead of each federal election, featuring testimony from U.S. officials, social media executives, and open source research executives. This is the first open hearing of this campaign season, but more will be coming. Now, I want to start by recalling the fact that I fear at times, since particularly the 2016 cycle was so long ago, that the public perception of past foreign election meddling has too often been treated as something that was trivial or not of major league. But as this committee's exhaustive bipartisan investigation into Russia's meddling in 2016 election showed, and as declassified intelligence community assessment showed, foreign influence efforts go well beyond simple online trolling or traditional propaganda. Foreign election efforts in the last 8 years have, among other things, involved efforts to infiltrate both online and in person a range of U.S. organizations on both sides of the political spectrum with the goal of stoking political polarization in the United States and promoting social and racial strife. We've seen as well successful impersonations of U.S. political and social organizations, with the Russian IRA, memorably back in 2016, having Twitter and Facebook accounts for the Tennessee GOP and Black Lives Matter. Both of those accounts were actually bigger than the real organizations. We've seen harassment and sting operations against U.S. candidates, particularly as when we saw just last cycle, the PRC influence operatives try to set up a sting operation to bully and humiliate a congressional candidate of Chinese heritage. We've seen successful efforts to actually organize real-world political rallies back in 2016 again, with one almost coming to real-life violence. Russian efforts orchestrated simultaneous rallies in Houston, one with an anti-Muslim event taking place at exactly the same time and place as a Muslim cultural event. Luckily, law enforcement intervened. We have also seen personalized emails sent in 2020 by Iranian influence actors posing as Proud Boys, which the Trump administration leadership did a good job of pointing out. Globally, we've seen many of the same foreign influence actors aggressively meddling in the elections of our democratic allies. The PRC's influence actors aggressively sought to shape the outcome of Taiwan's election earlier this year, including promoting narratives that the election had been rigged as Election Day neared. More recently, literally in the last few weeks, Czech and Belgian officials have disclosed efforts of Russian operatives to shape the outcome of June's EU elections with the goal of undermining European support for Ukraine. And a wide range of media open source research and other sources has similarly pointed to Russian influence operations in Slovakia, one of the cases that I think is particularly interesting, a country that when Russia invaded, 75% plus of the Slovaks supported Ukraine. A few years later, due to Russian efforts, Slovakia now has a pro-Russian president, and literally 55% of the Slovaks have been polled saying they think the United States started the war in Ukraine. We've seen recently as well deep fakes of the Moldavian president have been widely circulated. And fresh off the presses, just a couple hours, I'm not going to ask our witnesses to testify, but a new Russian effort geared at somehow saying that Zelensky and the CIA are working on trying to undermine again our elections in this year. The barriers to entry for foreign malign influence have unfortunately become incredibly small. Since 2016, we've seen declassified intelligence assessments name a whole host of influence actors who've engaged in, or at least contemplated, election influence and interference activities. Not only Russia, not only Iran or PRC, but also Cuba, Venezuela, terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, and a range of foreign hacktivists and profit-motivated cyber criminals. One of the things, and why I think this hearing is so important, in many ways, our adversaries could be more sophisticated and aggressive in both scale and scope in this election even than in prior years. Let me tell you why I think that's the case. First, our adversaries are more incentivized than ever to intervene in our elections because they can understand that it could affect their particular national interest. In the case of Russia, Putin clearly understands that influencing public opinion and shaping elections in the United States is a cheap way to erode American and Western support for Ukraine. Similarly, we've seen the conflict between Israel and Hamas has been fertile ground for disinformation since October 7th. Second, the scale and sophistication of these sorts of attacks against our elections can now be accelerated by AI tools. The truth is, the kind of audio and video manipulation that even as recently as 4 years ago, and clearly 8 years ago, was still a challenge, now can happen at a speed and scale due to AI tools that's unprecedented. And literally, there's not a week or month that goes by that those AI video and audio tools don't continue to improve. And I just, on a personal note, I fear that Congress's inability to pass any new guardrails in the last 18 months for AI-enabled mischief really could pose a huge problem. We've already seen fake video of President Trump embracing Dr. Fauci. We've seen audios of President Biden telling people to use a different voting day in New Hampshire. The truth is, these tools are out there and growing in their danger. Third, we've seen, unfortunately, increasingly large numbers of Americans of all political stripes across the political spectrum who simply don't trust U.S. institutions from federal agencies and law enforcement to mainstream media, who increasingly rely on the wildest conspiracy theories imaginable that pop up on the web. And fourth, since 2022, we've seen a concerted litigation campaign that has sought to undermine the federal government's ability to share on any kind of voluntary basis vital threat information with social media platforms. And unfortunately, since 2022, we've seen from some of those same social media platforms considerable disinvestment and, in certain cases, utter disinterest in platform integrity by some of those social media companies. And an area where the vice chairman and I have worked very closely together, we've seen the rise of a dominant social media platform, TikTok, with ownership based in a country that is clearly adversarial in terms of their intents on our elections. It is these kinds of attempts by foreign actors and adversaries to sow disinformation, undermine confidence in elections, and seed discord that Americans can expect their federal agencies, both law enforcement and intelligence, to help detect and defeat. We've got to do a better job of making sure Americans of all political stripes understand what is very probably coming their way over the next less than 6 months. I hope today's witnesses can provide a comprehensive overview of these and current threats and anything that may be emerging, and what we can do in a collaborative, cooperative, bipartisan way to make sure that the public is aware of this, I think, dramatic threat to our democracy. With that, I'll turn it to the Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Thanks for calling this hearing, and thank you all for being here on this important topic. And by the way, it's one I think we're going to be dealing with for the next quarter century. but it's hopefully one we get to learn from experience on. I always think it's important at the outset to sort of, because I know this will be discussed as an election, threats to the election is a broad topic, and it's always bifurcated into two things. There's election interference, which is trying to hack into the voter database or messing with the early reporting, unofficial reporting system of a state, things of that nature. That's more easily understood. And then there is this whole topic of influence. And it's not just in elections, it's also in our debates. I mean, we saw elements of that during COVID. We see it during policy debates here on a range of topics. The propaganda has always been a weapon of war. I think today you can do it at scale, faster, more convincing, and in ways that spread very quickly and are difficult to contain, and in particular, we've seen this globally. I mean, we've seen increasing amount of damage that's being done to the reputation of the United States and parts of Africa by a very active effort to undermine, make life very difficult for our diplomats who serve in that region, our military personnel in some of these countries where, you know, the Russians have moved in and gained greater influence. So all of that is happening at a global scale, and the chairman's already talked about some of the countries that have faced efforts to meddle in their elections and try to influence and steer the outcome, and in some cases successfully. But today, I think the focus is going to be on how this could be used in an election and in policy debates too, but let's focus on elections for a moment. And the reason why I want to really focus on that is I think we'll hear a lot about the tools that are available, the capabilities that someone has to put out an AI video, to spread narratives that are difficult to knock down and so forth, the weaponization of this information. What I think I hope to learn a little bit more about is when this happens, if this happens, who's in charge of responding to it? Have we thought through the process of what do we do when one of these scenarios occurs? Because I don't think I have a clear understanding of who's in charge and how we would respond, who would take the lead. I know that if a hurricane is headed towards the United States, the National Hurricane Center is going to put meteorologists on the air who are going to describe to us, this is the hurricane, this is what it looks like, this is how strong it's going to be when it gets here. They're going to put out forecasts. It's going to issue warnings, and people, Republicans, Democrats, no matter who you're going to vote for, are going to take the appropriate steps. If something like that were headed towards our election, I don't know who's in charge of putting it out there. More importantly, I think no matter who puts it out there, the candidate or issue on the other side of it, their followers are going to question whether it's the government interfering in the elections themselves. And it's not helpful, as an example, and I use this as an example because it's a very recent one. When the whole laptop situation happened, the Hunter Biden laptop, a number of former intelligence officials, I get it, their former is no longer in the employ of any of these agencies, but that title carries weight, all signed a letter saying this has all the hallmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign. We know now that it was not a disinformation campaign. I don't want to get into the particulars of what was on it. I'm just saying we now know that it was not a Russian disinformation campaign. But the result of it was that social media companies would not allow anyone to post the articles, and there was a media blackout. It could not be reported in any other except for one place. And so what happens as a result of that, whether it had an influence on the election or not, the result of it now is that we have some segment of the country who repeatedly says things like the intelligence community interfered, even these reformers, but that title. And so why that is relevant here is because no matter who this disinformation campaign is geared after, the other side is going to say the people issuing the warnings are people that are interfering in the elections on behalf of the candidate they favor. So we're in a real quandary here. But I do think we have to begin by at least understanding if something were to happen, if tomorrow there was a video, very convincing video of a candidate, for, let's not say president, let's say U.S. Senate or Congress, and a video comes out with 72 hours to go before Election Day of that candidate saying some racist comment or doing something horrifying, but it's fake. Who is in charge of letting people know this thing is fake? This thing is not real. So that we can have people are going to go to the ballot box believing something that's not real is real. That's influencing our election, especially a close one. And I ask myself, whoever's in charge of it, what are we doing to protect the credibility of the entity that is, whoever it is in charge of saying it, so that the other side does not come out and say our own government is interfering in the election. So I think we're going to be struggling with this for a very long time because the Russians are the best at it. They've been doing it a long time, and so they know and they've perfected it. But every election cycle, more and more cast of characters are joining the parade here in terms of getting into this business. And I think in the years to come, we're going to see more and more nation states and maybe non-state actors begin to not just, you know, come after us in our elections and our political process, but those of other countries as well. So this issue is not going away anytime soon. I think it's only going to accelerate. It's going to get worse. And we really need to begin to lay out some parameters about how we're going to respond to these things in a coordinated way that we know ahead of time, as opposed to the ad hoc basis in which this has been handled in years past in terms of responding to the disinformation piece of it. It's a tough one to handle, but it's one that, that I think we have to get a handle on.
I agree. I'm not sure. I think, Director Haynes, you're going to lead us off.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Chairman Warner, Ranking Member Rubio, and members of the committee. I really appreciate having the opportunity to brief you on the intelligence community election security work alongside my colleagues at CISA and FBI who are leading efforts to take actions to secure our elections alongside the extraordinary state and local officials who are on the front lines of this work. The U.S. government's efforts to protect our elections have improved significantly since the 2016 presidential election, and even as the threat landscape is becoming increasingly complicated, it is my view that the U.S. government has never been better prepared to address the challenge. Protecting our democratic processes from foreign influence or interference is an absolute priority for the intelligence community. Our efforts are effectively organized by the Foreign Malign Influence Center, or FMIC, which houses the Election Threats Executive. And the Election Threats Executive leads, coordinates, and integrates the IC's activities, initiatives, and programs in this realm. And fundamentally, we support the federal government, particularly CISA and the FBI, as they work to secure our elections, as well as state and local election officials across the country who actually manage and secure the election infrastructure on a day-to-day basis. We do so by ensuring that our resources are aligned to promote collection and analysis so that we're able to identify and mitigate foreign threats to our elections and communicate our assessments to our federal partners, to you in Congress, to state and local officials, and to the American people. We also facilitate a notification framework that ensures that when relevant intelligence is collected concerning a foreign influence operation aimed at our election, appropriate notice is given to those who are being targeted so that they can take action. And while most of these notifications are non-public, there are, as you both indicated, scenarios in which public notifications are appropriate, and if doing so would render the foreign influence operation less effective, and that is part of that mandate. Of course, exposing a foreign actor's efforts is only one way in which we counter election threats. We support the law enforcement community as they disrupt election influence operations through legal action, including the disruption of illicit financial networks. And we also support Cybercom as it conducts a range of cyber operations to ensure that foreign adversaries cannot use our digital infrastructure to attack our elections. Using every tool we have is critical as the challenge is expanding. Over the last several years, we've seen really three trends that make the threat landscape more diverse and more complex. First, there are an increasing number of foreign actors, including non-state entities, who are looking to engage in election influence activities. Second, there are more commercial firms through which state actors are able to conduct election influence activities, often increasing the sophistication of such activities while making it more challenging to track down the original instigator of the foreign influence efforts. And then third, perhaps most obviously, relevant emerging technologies, particularly generative AI and big data analytics, are increasing the threat by enabling the proliferation of influence actors who can conduct targeted campaigns, reducing the number of relatively sophisticated influence operations and content, and further complicating attribution. For example, innovations in AI have enabled foreign influence actors to produce seemingly authentic and tailored messaging more efficiently at greater scale and with content adapted for different languages and cultures. In fact, we've already seen generative AI being used in the context of foreign elections. In September 2023, 2 days before the parliamentary elections in Slovakia, which, Chairman, you noted, a fake audio recording was released online in which one candidate discussed how to rig the upcoming election with a journalist. The audio was quickly shown to be fake with signs of AI manipulation, but under Slovakia law, there is a moratorium on campaigning and media commentary about the election for 48 hours before polls open. And since the deepfake was released in that window, news and government organizations struggled to expose the manipulation. And the victim of the deepfake ended up losing in a very close election. To position the IC to address generative AI-enabled foreign influence efforts, we have an IC group focused on multimedia authentication that leverages DARPA's semantic forensics technology, among other tools, and enables those in the IC who are working on election security to rapidly access media forensic experts to facilitate the authentication of foreign suspect media related to the US election. Members of this group regularly engage technical experts inside and outside of the government to ensure we are applying the latest techniques. And if state and local officials have concerns, for example, about media that is suspected to be synthetic or manipulated and violates a law or is tied to a foreign actor, they can request authentication assistance through the FBI. And of course, the most significant foreign actors who engage in foreign influence activity directed at the United States in relation to our elections are Russia, are the People's Republic of China, or PRC, and Iran. Specifically, Russia remains the most active foreign threat to our elections. The Russian government's goals in such influence operations tend to include eroding trust in US democratic institutions, exacerbating socio-political divisions in the United States, and degrading Western support to Ukraine. Russia relies on a vast multimedia influence apparatus, which consists of its intelligence services, cyber actors, state media proxies, and social media trolls. Moscow most likely views such operations as a means to tear down the United States as its perceived primary adversary, enabling Russia to promote itself as a great power, whereas Beijing seeks to promote support for China's policy positions and perspectives, including in the context of specific elections, portray the US democratic model as chaotic, ineffective, unrepresentative, and magnify US societal divisions. And the PRC also has a sophisticated influence apparatus through which they leverage emerging technologies, including generative AI, and they are growing increasingly confident in their ability to influence elections globally, but remain concerned about the possible blowback in the event their efforts are disclosed. In fact, in 2020, we assessed that China did not deploy influence efforts intended to change the outcome of the US presidential election, principally because of concerns regarding blowback if caught. And thus far, we have no information to suggest that the PRC will take a more active role in this presidential election than it did in 2020, even as they continue to engage in efforts to promote politicians at all levels who are taking positions favorable to China on key issues. Needless to say, we will continue to monitor their activities. Finally, Iran is becoming increasingly aggressive in their efforts, seeking to stoke discord and undermine confidence in our democratic institutions, as we've seen them do in prior election cycles. They continue to adapt their cyber and influence activities using social media platforms, issuing threats, disseminating disinformation, and it is likely that they will continue to rely on their intelligence services in these efforts and Iran-based online influencers to promote their narratives. We've also observed other countries attempt to support or undermine specific candidates, but these efforts tend to be on a smaller scale. For instance, some other countries do things like direct campaign contributions to candidates they believe would promote their interest if elected and seek to obscure their support. In brief, the election threat landscape is increasingly challenging, but our capacity to manage the threat has also improved, as you will hear from colleagues. There is nothing more important or fundamental to our democracy than protecting our elections, and I can tell you that we are focused and ready to do our part, and I thank you for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Chairman, Vice Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss CISA's efforts to protect and defend our nation's election infrastructure. Since 2017, when election infrastructure was designated as critical and CISA was designated as the sector risk management agency, CISA and our partners, including the intelligence community and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, have made significant progress increasing the security and resilience of the nation's election infrastructure, working to support state and local election officials who serve on the front lines of our democracy, administering, managing, and securing our elections. Election infrastructure has never been more secure, and the election stakeholder community has never been stronger. As a result, these election officials ran secure elections in 2018 and 2020 and in 2022, as you know. There is no evidence that malicious actors changed, deleted, or altered votes or had any material impact on the outcome of any of these elections. This, of course, has been validated time and again, including in multiple court challenges. And in any race that was close in 2020, there were paper records that could be counted and recounted and audited to ensure accuracy. In this job, I've had the privilege to spend time with chief election officials across the nation of both parties, and I know how tirelessly they work to ensure that their citizens' votes are counted as cast. It's why I have confidence in the integrity of our elections and why the American people should as well. However, we cannot be complacent. While election infrastructure is more secure than ever, as you just heard, the threat environment is more complex than ever. We have seen, as the DNI noted, that foreign adversaries remain a persistent threat to our election infrastructure, aiming to undermine American confidence in election integrity and our democratic institutions, and to sow partisan discord. These are efforts which will be exacerbated by generative AI capabilities. Perhaps more concerning are the continued physical threats to election officials, which largely stem from unfounded claims that the results of the 2020 election did not represent the will of the American people. Such claims are corrosive to the sacred foundations of our democracy, and they have led to harassment and threats of violence against election officials of both parties and their families. As a result, we've seen a wave of resignations, with election officials taking operational experience and institutional knowledge with them, and some of those who remain are operating under difficult conditions. We at CISA are very proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with these election officials, these election heroes, who are on the front lines of our democracy. In fact, CISA is providing more services in more jurisdictions than ever before, with training and resources featured on our Protect 2024 website. Since the beginning of 2023, we've provided over 340 cybersecurity assessments, 520 physical security assessments, 70 tabletop exercises, 220 training sessions that reach 9,000 election stakeholders every week. We provide reports to nearly 1,000 election entities with highlighting vulnerabilities so they can be immediately remediated. We've provided and sponsored 230 security clearances for election officials and worked with the intelligence community to provide classified briefings on foreign adversary threats. And most recently, we hired 10 dedicated regional election security advisors who bring a combined 210 years of election expertise and experience to work on the front lines with election officials. Finally, we remain laser focused on the threat of foreign malign influence operations, providing guidance as recent as last month on the tactics of disinformation used by our foreign adversaries. We'll continue to use our rumor versus reality website to provide accurate information about election infrastructure security, and perhaps most importantly, we will amplify the voices of state and local election officials who are the true authoritative subject matter experts when it comes to elections. These election officials know that while elections are political, election security is not, and we at CISA are committed to keeping it that way and look for your leadership and support in helping us do so. Thank you.
And it's my understanding, Ms. Knapp, you're not going to do opening, right? Let me, first of all, thank the witnesses for their testimony and particularly acknowledge what Jen Easterly just said is, you know, our election officials are our election heroes, and many of them who serve diligently opening and closing polls for decades on end, the fact that they are under a level of harassment at this point really is one of the most serious efforts, I think, to undermine our democracy. Some of that may be domestically generated, but some of that could also be enhanced by foreign interest. Let me direct my first question to Director Haynes. Again, I think there has been some rewriting post-2016 that somehow some of the activities in Russia or even in 2020 with Iran, that was kind of harmless trolling. Can you speak to the fact that literally the level of violence that was incited in cases or exacerbating racial strife, religious strife, these adversaries, these foreign adversaries, are trying to pit us against each other at unprecedented levels, literally leading to violence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you did a very nice job in the opening of highlighting a number of such incidents. I will say that just starting with Iran, it is, as I noted in the opening statement, increasingly aggressive in their efforts, seeking to stoke this kind of discord and promote chaos and undermine confidence in the integrity of the process. And they use social media platforms really to issue threats, to disseminate disinformation. And we saw how they did that in 2020. That's one of the incidents that you identified, where they attempted to incite violence and threaten voters by sending spoofed emails designed to intimidate the voters, to incite social unrest, and distributing content, basically including a video that implied that individuals could cast fraudulent ballots, even from overseas, all entirely false, called out by my predecessor, Director Ratcliffe at the time in 2020, and others in the intelligence community and law enforcement community. So I think that is a very good example. We've also seen Russia engage in these types of tactics, particularly in their global efforts to influence elections, trying to effectively incite disorder in order to distract sometimes law enforcement from being able to manage an election or do other things in that respect as well. I'll leave it at that.
And I would just say, I recall that incident, and again, it was a little bit of what Senator Rubio's question about, you know, who announces. And there was a real show of force at that moment when we had the ODNI, we had the FBI director, we had the head of CISA. I believe, I'm not sure whether General Nakasone should, but it was, you know, because our fear is who makes that message in a politicized environment. It needs to be people who are going to be viewed as much as possible credibly by both sides. And I think, again, in that case, the Trump administration did the right thing. Lots and lots of talk about AI. There's not a week that goes by that we don't see a new enhancement in terms of either video or audio deepfake capabilities. I don't think, even though we passed some bipartisan legislation out of the Rules Committee today that will get to national legislation on deepfakes, I would point out there's about a dozen plus states that have taken this on their own, and they range from red states to blue states and everything in between. So, and those of us who've been pushing the tech companies to do more, there were 20 tech companies that came together in what was called the Munich Accord. And this includes all of the big, it's the Facebooks, it's the Googles, it is also Twitter, TikTok, Anthropic, OpenAI, promising that they would have a commonality of watermarking so you can indicate if something has been altered. This is AI in elections. A commitment to try to take that content down and to educate voters. This was not just geared at America. Half the world is going to elections this year. Right now, India's got an election. The Europeans will have their parliamentary election shortly in June. I worry that after that much publicized announcement in February, to use the old political term, where's the beef? I don't see that common watermarking standard emerging. I don't see these 20 tech companies moving in the aggressive nature that I would hope. I'd like to hear briefly from each of the witnesses on how you think the state of the collaboration between tech companies on making sure AI is not misused.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Chairman. I saw the letter that you sent out to those companies yesterday, which I think will be very helpful in getting specific answers. I will say we've been working with the generative AI companies specifically about threats to elections and ensuring that they are putting procedures and technology in place. Many of them are part of what's called CCPA, the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authentication. In addition, one of the very useful things that they're doing is if there are any questions about elections, they're actually driving people who use that technology to sources like canivote.org or Trusted Info 2024, which is the National Association of Secretary of State. Information that provides verified information at the state and local level. So it's really a validation that they are pushing people to those trusted sources. All that said, what we are doing are providing guidance to state and local election officials on AI threats and ways that they can mitigate such threats to their election infrastructure. We put out something in January and again in April about foreign malign influence.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that by saying that absolutely support everything that Jen just indicated. In addition, I think we're seeing both the opportunity for them to continue to provide detection tools, building relationships with some of the state and local partners, and that's been a part of what I think is important to continue to encourage. I think we're still in the process of watching them build out essentially their capacity and efforts in this area, and so things like your statement I think are helpful to sort of channel that energy and to begin to push forward on it. I think another thing that we're obviously doing is we've been engaging with them in order to make sure that we understand the technologies they're bringing to bear to make sure that we're producing basically the state-of-the-art identification authentication services within the IC and also for state and local partners if they so request appropriately, as I indicated, through the FBI. And we're also promoting the adoption of DARPA's suite of technologies, frankly, in this area that really allows users to detect, to characterize falsified media assets, to defend in particular against large-scale automated disinformation attacks to public authorities and to third parties. So I think all of that is sort of mutually reinforcing in this area.
Ms. Knapp.
Thank you, sir, for the opportunity to respond. Obviously, AI is definitely a concern to us as well. Whenever we get any sort of intelligence, we do provide it to the social media companies for action. Sorry, can you hear me now? When we do get any sort of intel indicating the hand of a foreign adversary, that information is provided to social media companies, whether it is as simple as an internet protocol address, an email address, or a phone number for them to take what action deemed necessary.
All right, and I understand the talk about protecting the infrastructure. It's very important, but I want to focus on, and I'm going to largely base the scenario I'm about to outline, I'm going to base it on a CNN February 9th exclusive about a tabletop exercise, and it basically describes the following tabletop exercise. China creates a fake AI video showing a Senate candidate destroying ballots, and they're able to identify that it's AI, that it's fake. So we have the ability to do that, and I think that's what you've described the DNI's office is able to do through that, through DARPA, I guess, the effort, the semantic forensics technology and all that. Okay, so we know it's fake. What the article says, and what I want to know, maybe the article's wrong and you can correct me, is after that, in this tabletop exercise, no one knew what happened next. There was, they struggled to, on how, what the response should be. There was a struggle, who would notify the public? According to this article, no, and the number two at the FBI, number two at CIA, number two at DHS was part of this tabletop. Nobody raised their hand and says that we will do it. We want to be the ones in charge of notifying the public. There was real consternation if, in fact, this was being promoted through a cutout, like maybe I imagine like a blogger. Let's say there's a right-wing blogger or a left-wing blogger, and that person is the one that released the video. Now there was certain fear that if we go out and say that this video is fake and this person is spreading it, people are going to say the government itself is interfering in our elections. And then a real question about if so many Americans already don't trust the federal government or the intelligence agencies, you know, how can we get them to trust us that this is not a real video? So here's what I want to ask. If, in fact, the scenario like this plays out, video comes out. I'm not on the ballot this year, so let's use me. Video comes out, and it's me in an audio recording, fake, saying, yeah, I'm going to rig the election, and I'm going to steal a bunch of ballots. It's fake. You know it's fake. What happens at that point? Because I'm now a week before the election, 6 days before the election. Does someone notify me? Am I able to say that? Is someone going to come out and say, this is not real, he really didn't say that? What happens? Because this article says it would be turned over to state and local officials. I don't know what a state and local official is supposed to do. They're going to turn around and say, yes, the DNI's office or the FBI or somebody told us this was fake. I don't understand what the process that would happen at that point is. Do we have a process that would kick in a situation like that one that I just described?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I wasn't at the tabletop exercise, so I don't know what happened in that particular scenario, but I understand that's not actually an accurate representation of what the discussion was. I would say that in terms of what would happen, yes, there would be a statement. So I think the model that I pointed to in 2020 is an appropriate model if there is basically a video or some fake, some deep fake or disinformation that's being promoted. It could be that we find out about it through intelligence. It could be otherwise identified, and it would go through, if it's intelligence, through the notification framework. The notification framework is an interagency group that basically indicates, okay, we think this is something that deserves a public statement.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but yeah. I just wanted to ask you this for clarification. So the video is clearly fake.
Yeah.
You'll be able to, you may not be able to attribute it to a foreign entity, but you'll at least be able to say, this is not real, and we're working to see where it came from. Maybe it was designed by some guy in a basement, but maybe it was designed by a nation state.
Yeah.
But at a minimum, we have to be able to say, this thing is not real, and it could be the work of a foreign adversary. Who, I say we, but who would be, would you be the one that would stand up? Is it the DNI? Is it the FBI? Who would be the person that would stand before the American people and say, we're not interfering in the election. We just want you to know that video is not real. Who would be in charge of that?
Yeah, so I could be the person that goes out and makes that determination. And I'll just give you an example. Frankly, one of the ones that the chairman just mentioned from this morning. There's an article today about the fact that there is a fake video that was basically promoted, we think, by Storm 1516. It's a Russian-affiliated group, basically. And that video purports to show a whistleblower and a Ukrainian former employee of a made-up CIA-supported troll farm tasked with interfering in the upcoming presidential election. CIA immediately came out with a statement that basically indicates and is reflected in the article that this is fake, and I am here to say categorically that this claim is patently false, that there is no such thing. It is disinformation, and that is the kind of approach that we'll continue to take across the board.
Okay, but is that established that you would be, you say you could be the one that, I mean, who is, I guess my point is, I don't want there to be any gray area. Like, someone needs to be in charge of interfacing with the American people and ultimately saying, we will be responsible for notifying the American people.
Yes.
Has that been established?
The only hesitation that you hear from me is based on the fact that there may be certain circumstances in which, for example, a state or local official or other basically public authority is in a better position to make the public statement initially and for the rest of us to come back behind. So it's just a question going through the process and determining what exactly is the issue that's being raised, what's the fake information that's being put forward, who is going to be the best essentially official to immediately come out
and
disclaim it.
And who makes that decision about who the best
That's
person is?
That's through, for example, the notification framework.
I think it's a very valid question. And I'll remind colleagues, in open hearings, we go straight seniority. Senator Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's good to have all three of you here. And I'd like to start by saying I've long believed that you have to follow the money to understand election interference in America. And today I want to start with influence buying, because I think one very effective way for a foreign adversary to interfere in an election is to compromise a candidate. And the best way to do that is with money. Now, last year, Donald Trump argued to a court that the value of his assets could not be inflated because he could always find a Saudi buyer who would pay any price that he would suggest. The judge was just taken aback, and he wrote in his opinion that the statement of the former president suggested, quote, influence buying. So the question I'd like to ask you, Director Haynes, is let's set aside Donald Trump, okay, for purposes of this question. Is a foreign country's influence buying of a candidate, in your view, a counterintelligence concern and a form of interference?
Absolutely. And it's a tactic that we've seen, for example, the Chinese engage in quite regularly.
Good. Then let's go to data purchases, something you and I have talked about, because one way for a foreign adversary to tailor their influence is through the purchase of large amounts of Americans' private data. The executive order that President Biden signed on February 28th and the data export bill included in the recent foreign military and supplemental, those were welcome steps, and I think you know I've indicated that. But unlike the bipartisan bill I have with Vice Chairman Rubio, they only apply to a handful of countries, which in my view means they just don't really get the job done. So the question here, Director Haynes, is couldn't the countries covered by the executive order and the recently enacted data export legislation like China and Russia, couldn't they just get the data from countries that aren't covered, either by taking advantage of weak privacy laws or setting up front companies?
I think it's sort of fact-specific, and it's hard for me to make a very broad generalization, but there's no question that both Russia and China, for example, look to obtain critical information, including, for example, polling data that ultimately allows them to determine the targets of their influence campaigns, including with respect to funding illicitly.
So would you work with the vice chairman, Senator Rubio, and I to clean up these loopholes and pass effective legislation? Because it just seems to me we can say there's progress, no question about that, but you're just going to have a lot of the people who are engaging in these corrupt activities just make their way to countries that aren't covered. Then they're going to look at weak privacy laws, they're going to look at front companies, and bam, we're off to the races again with more corruption of the election process. So I think we need to have the bill that the vice chair and I put in to really close that loophole. And I gather I ought to quit while I'm ahead because you said you'll work with us.
Absolutely. I'd work with you on really any legislation you have to offer. So
very
please.
Good.
Thank you.
So with respect to this election worker issue question for you, Ms. Knapp, we got a lot of interest in this strong statement that Director Ray put out. Wanted to make sure we protect election workers from threats of violence. This is something I hear from all of our county officials in my state. This is a obvious and ongoing threat to democracy. Tell us, if you would, Ms. Knapp, what you are involved with in this area about the harassment of election workers, the general incitement of violence. What are your priorities in this area?
Thank you for that question, sir. Obviously, as you had said, election workers are critical to our democratic process, and they are the front line of democracy. In terms of what we're seeing in this space is obviously election workers are being harassed via robocalls, via white powder letters, as well as swatting. And we take all of those incidents very seriously. We work very closely with the Department of Justice's Election Crimes Task Force. To date, since its inception in 2021, there have been 17 successful convictions, as well as 13 sentencing. We continuously work with state and local authorities on these matters to hold any and all individuals that have been identified accountable for those actions.
My time is up. I'm going to ask you a question for the record, Ms. Knapp, about this gentleman, Alexander Smirnoff, and he was recently charged with lying to the Bureau, as you know, when he passed on disinformation about the Biden family. I'll ask you for the record. My time's up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Risch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand. I apologize. We were in a Foreign Relations Committee meeting, but I apologize. I think Senator Rubio made reference to the letter which he and I sent to you, Director Haynes, regarding the 51 former intelligence community people who signed the letter regarding Hunter Biden. Does that ring a bell with you at all?
Yes, sir. I don't remember every detail of it, but I certainly remember the letter.
I'm going to help you out here.
Good deal. Thank you, sir.
No, it isn't a good deal, but I'm going to help you out. We asked six questions, and only one of those six questions was answered. So I'm going to ask you here publicly. And by the way, let me tell you how this fits in. I'm as concerned with this sort of thing as I am with foreign interference on the election process. And this was deplorable, these 51 people saying this was Russian activity, when we all know now that it wasn't. I mean, these were 51 people that had very significant influence in American society, and they sent this letter saying that this was Russian influence. So let me ask some questions here. One of the questions we asked is how many of those 51 people currently hold security clearance? And that was as of May 31st of 2023. So let me ask it now. How many of those 51 people still hold a security clearance?
I believe we provided you with an answer on that. I don't recall the... I thought we did. All right, if we did not, we will get that to you shortly. We have that information.
All right, so how many of the Appendix A individuals maintain business arrangements, contracts, or other consulting arrangements with any element of the U.S. intelligence community between October 1, 2020 and October of 2020? That question was not answered.
Yes, sir. That question we're still trying to get an answer to.
You're still trying to get an answer to it?
Yes, sir.
This is security clearance as of October of 2020. Surely you got a list of these people, whether or not they had security clearance in October.
We have a list of the people that had security clearances. As I said, that's an answer that I thought we had provided. We will provide that to you. On the contracts, that's a much more complicated question, and that's something that we're looking to give you.
How many of the Appendix A individuals currently maintain business arrangements, contracts, or other consulting element of the U.S. intelligence community? And that was as of May 31st, 2023. And move that forward to today, both of those last two questions. How many of those people, of those 51, had the arrangements in October of 2020, and how many of them have any contacts today? Could you get that information for us?
I don't have that information now, but we will look to provide it to you.
Okay. So let's talk about this particular problem. Senator Rubio was asking the question about who's going to stand up and look in the camera and say, this is baloney. That's going to be you, I think you've said. That's the high responsibility that you have. And that was in the context of foreign interference in an election. What about this sort of thing, where it's domestic interference that's obviously false? Who's got the responsibility for standing up and looking in the camera and saying, folks, don't count on this, it's not true? Is that going to be your responsibility?
Sir, I think, look, my responsibility with respect to formers that speak out and provide the wealth of their experience and knowledge in such circumstances is not to determine what they should or shouldn't say, but rather to ensure that they're not disclosing classified information, that we're protecting that and dealing with that. It's not, yeah.
What if it's false and they're using their robes of their... having knowledge of security matters and intelligence matters, and you know it's false, is that your response, or do you just say, no, I'm not going to get involved in that?
I don't understand, because I think, first of all, I think they said that their experience makes them deeply suspicious of that activity, right? And I wouldn't...
They went a little farther than that, I think, but I'll take your... characterization of it.
Okay.
And if you know that's false and you come into the information that it's false, is it your obligation or not your obligation to stand up, look in the camera and say, folks, when you're voting, don't take this into account?
Sarah, I don't think I could even, frankly, make sure that I've read everything that a former might have said or that anybody else has on these issues. So, no, I don't think that it's appropriate for me to be determining what is truth and what is false in such circumstances.
But what if you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you're sitting here. You're the center of intelligence in America right there. And this has come out, and you know it's false. What's your obligation, or do you have any?
I think my obligation is to ensure that the best intelligence is being provided to the president, to the federal government, to the Congress, and where possible to the American people through declassifications, which we would do.
Not calling out someone who stands up and purports to have intelligence information that you know is false.
Sarah, if I were to, first of all, I'm not sure I'm the best arbiter of what is true and false. And secondly—
Let's say in a particular instance, you've seen the paper. You know it's false. Let's take that instance. What do you do?
I mean, it depends on the situation. If we're talking about a fake video that's been put forward—
Somebody with intelligence credentials stands up and says, I know this from an intelligence standpoint, and you know, as the director of national intelligence, that it's false.
No,
what
I do,
do
not.
You do?
I do not consider that to be part of my responsibility. Okay. If there is disinformation that is put forward, false information, right, then we have the capacity to authenticate it or to identify it as false. We will do so basically to our customers, and there will be a process whereby determinations are made. And
public.
It may be to the public, but it might be classified information. It might be anything else. I don't know. under the circumstances. It's too much of a hypothetical.
I'm not making progress, so I'm going to give it back to you.
We ought to continue to pursue this. I mean, my sense that would probably be the responsibility of the FBI if there was proven. I'm not sure we want the Director of National Intelligence commenting about a domestic statement made by an American. But I understand your point. I mean, I think that...
Well, that's the purpose of this hearing, is to find out how American voters are going to be kept
but although
informed,
the
what's true and what's false.
It is, although the purpose, our purview at least, is focused on that foreign influence. But I understand your point. Senator King.
Well, following up on this point, it seems to me the tension here is, I don't want the U.S. government to be the truth police. If you start talking about what's true and what's not true in political advertising, you know, you could have 1,000 people doing that full-time, 24 hours a day. That's not the job of the U.S. government. It strikes me that the role you can play, however, is disclosure of sources. That if you know through your intelligence sources and your attribution that a particular piece of information, true or not, is coming from a foreign source, that's the role where it's important for you to notify the public so they know the source, not whether it's true or not, because I just think that's an impossible determination. But at least people should know the source. In a main town meeting, when somebody stands up to talk, you assess not only what they say, but who they are, and you're not allowed to wear a bag over your head in a main town meeting. And so that's where I think you have an important role to play. And the thing that bothers me and worries me, you use the word notification framework. I've seen that. It's a bureaucratic nightmare. A notification that comes in February after a November election ain't any good. And what I want to urge is disclosure of sources when you're aware of it immediately. Mark Twain said it, you know, it takes good news, bad news gets around the world before good news gets its shoes tied. So I hope that you can go back and look at this process and not make it bureaucratic, but if you have evidence that this is coming from a foreign source, let the public know so they can assess that. Is that something you can take back?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is something that we do, is try to attribute where information is coming from, essentially, and working through the methodologies on that. And I realize notification framework may sound quite bureaucratic, but it really is a living thing. And for example, they have worked through a process where they can expedite their decision-making process through within 48 hours. They can, looking at
that
even
should be the
making
standard.
That smaller.
48 hours should be the outside.
Across the board. Yeah, it's not much longer than that.
Because
in terms
having
of
this
standard.
Information that it's foreign sourced within the U.S. government doesn't do us any good if the election is 5 days away and you don't get that information
yeah,
out
absolutely.
To the public.
Agreed.
Because what's going on here is our adversaries are using our strength against us. It's a kind of geopolitical jujitsu. The strength of our society is its openness, the First Amendment, freedom of expression. They're using that in order to manipulate our most fundamental sacred right, which is the right of an election. And so we've got to be alert to it. And as I say, I disagree with my colleague. I don't think you're in the truth or falsehood business. I think you're in the disclosure of intelligence business. And I hope that that's something you can continue. Now, at CISA, I'm worried that you may be overly concerned with appearing partisan and that will freeze you in terms of taking the actions that are necessary. You gave a very impressive list of all the meetings and things that you're doing. But I'm hearing from some election officials that they don't feel that CISA is out there with them. They're not getting the support that they need. So I hope that you're being very forward-leaning about the work that you the protection you can provide to state and local election officials.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. Actually, as I mentioned, we are providing more services in more jurisdictions than ever before. We've actually enhanced our field force of cybersecurity advisors, physical security advisors, and then election security advisors who are former secretaries of state or state election directors who are working hand in hand with secretaries of state and current state election directors. And I am in touch with chief election officials across the country, to include Secretary of State Bellows. and others to ensure that they are getting everything that they need to run safe and secure elections. And that's not been affected in any of a partisan way.
Please ramp it up. We've got about 6 months, and this is we know that these adversaries are going to be coming at us. Final question. We know that in 2016, and I believe in 2018, the Russians got into something like 35 states' election infrastructure. They didn't do anything with it. There was no effort to manipulate voting lists, but they weren't doing it for fun. I'm worried that they're still there, and that the potential for example, people walking into a polling place in Miami and finding their name has disappeared off the list, the potential for chaos is very high. So I hope all of you are pursuing those, I call them sleeper cells, that may still be there in state election infrastructure.
I'll just comment that since we have designated election infrastructure as critical, there's been enormous progress, in particular, in raising the bar on cybersecurity. So as you know, not all of voting equipment, vote tabulation and vote casting is not connected to the internet, just vote registration and election night reporting. So that the fact that it's disconnected, it's not exposed to the internet, that's a layer of security. But there are also multiple layers. Election officials take a defense in depth approach, technological layers, physical layers, procedural controls to ensure that that election infrastructure is secure and resilient. The other thing that's important to remember, Senator, is that we have so much diversity across our election infrastructure. If you've seen one state,
it's a benefit.
It's a benefit. If you've seen one state's election, you've seen one state's election. And so the virtue is there are procedures and controls under the chief election officials that makes that election equipment secure. And having worked with folks like Secretary of State McCrane in Idaho, I know that all election officials are focused laser-like on this, and they don't see elections security as a partisan political issue. They see it as an issue of ensuring that they can enable every one of their citizens' votes to be counted as cast.
Final quick question. Director Haynes, did you hear about the three conspiracy theorists that walked into a bar?
No.
It wasn't a coincidence.
That's great. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the good news. Director Haynes, you said we're never been better prepared. Ms. Easterly, you said our elections have never been more secure. I think that's good news. All the campaigns I've been involved in my career and or observed as a citizen have never been exemplars of truth-telling. They are contests, political contests for the hearts and minds of the voters and hopefully the ballot cast by that voter. And I frankly don't think it makes a whole lot of difference if it's some message is generated by some computer code or algorithm or artificial intelligence or a human being that is not telling the truth, or some third party like these 51 intelligence officials who basically shared in a lie attributing certain information in election to Russian disinformation. I actually found also, Ms. Easterly, I found this statement in your statement to be reassuring. You said, our election infrastructure is diverse, managed locally by state and local government offices to meet their unique jurisdictional requirements, and involves in-depth layers of defense and redundancies to ensure security and resilience. It is because of these measures and the incredible efforts of election workers across the country that the American people can have confidence in the security of our elections process. Again, more good news. As I read that, though, it seems to suggest that the distributed nature of our election system is actually a strength against attempts to disrupt our election process. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So any attempt by federal officials here in Washington, D.C. to centralize or concentrate that election authority would seem to me to run counter to that distributed structure which is providing some defense against attempts to disrupt or interfere with our elections. That's my observation, not necessarily yours. So I was very encouraged to see that the work you've done with chief election officials in places like Texas and elsewhere, the training, the assessments, the resources you provided have been successful and led you to believe that we have never been more secure. Let me ask you, maybe Ms. Knapp, I don't know who should take this question, but one of the biggest challenges we've had when it comes to elections or cyber attacks basically have been attribution. How do we know what the source of some of this information or cyber attacks, let's say, how do we know what who it is?
Thank you for that question, sir. I can certainly start, and then I'm sure my colleagues would love to jump in. As you had mentioned, sir, attribution is a difficult thing, but it is not something that is impossible, and it takes time. So for us, from an FBI perspective, you know, that would involve us tracing the origin. We would gather all available intelligence. We would serve legal process. You know, we would, it's an iterative process.
So that's not something you could do in real time, let's say, against the deadline or backdrop of an election date?
Well, it would depend. It would depend on how easy it is to have attribution. It would also depend on what sort of available intelligence is out there driving us to come to whatever conclusion. But I don't know if any of my colleagues want to jump in on this.
And Ms. Director Haynes, does the U.S. government do anything to impose costs against those who engage in this misconduct?
I mean, obviously that's a policy question, but yes, obviously there have been actions that have been taken, well, sanctions.
It
or
may
other...
be a policy question, but you would know.
Yeah. Fair enough. No. I mean, I think, you know, sanctions are an example of the kinds of actions that have been taken, PNGing, other actions depending on the particular scenario. And we've also seen, as we've been helping, for example, Europe look at Russian efforts to influence the European Parliament elections, they've been taking certain actions in response to some of those influence operations. So I do think there are, in fact, tools that can be used, and others may wish to join.
I just have 17 seconds left. Let me change the subject a little bit. We've talked about virtual threats to election integrity, but not physical threats from terrorist groups. Director Haynes, you said in your annual threat assessment you're willing to acknowledge that perceptions of immigration policies are driving record numbers of illegal immigrants across our borders. Director Haynes also talked about the ISIS-affiliated individuals that are facilitating the passage of migrants to the U.S.-Mexican border and into the United States. Can you tell us in open session how many illegal immigrants have ties to ISIS operatives? And does the IC assess that individuals with those connections have entered the United States through the southern border, as Director Ray has testified?
I can support what Director Ray has testified to publicly, but I can't answer your specific questions in open session, but we can obviously have further
discussions.
You can't
tell us what he told us, which is ISIS facilitators have managed to deliver people to the southern border, and they have likely been released into the United States?
There is a facilitation network that we have been monitoring, obviously, that has some links to ISIS, and that is something that we have been managing, but I can't go further into detail on that without being in closed session, sir.
Well, I think we are looking at a matter of when, if not if, we're going to have to live with the consequences of that.
Two quick comments before we go to Senator Bennett. One, you know, I do think as policymakers, and I think there have been times in the past when we have punched back against some of those who try to interfere, and I think we ought to do more of that and try to urge as policymakers that action. And I would also say I want to commend, I mean, some of this part you made with Jen about the decentralized nature. I want to applaud Texas, which in an overwhelming way, I think almost unanimous in your state house and 75%, I think, in your state senate, approved legislation that the governor Abbott side prohibiting deep fakes of political candidates. I think that makes a lot of sense. Senator Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for holding this hearing. It's a tough set of issues because we live in a free society. We're all, one way or another, I think we're all trying to help strengthen this democracy, help strengthen the values that we all that we share, and we're under assault, you know, in a way that we've never been before from our adversaries. And they're, I think, competing. We've got competing values at stake here. You know, the First Amendment on the one hand, protecting our national security on the other hand. I was reading Director Haynes, the piece in Wired last week about the Russian disinformation campaign, the doppelganger operation, the Kremlin-backed operation that promoted a fake Washington Post article that said that billionaire Soros was hiring people at $30 for anti-Semitism. And this site looked just like the Washington Post, you know, and the people in this country that were having protests in the United States were basically being attacked in a sense by this propaganda, by this effort to divide us. And these guys working, I think, with the Russians have fabricated articles from Le Monde and Fox News as well. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about the speed, and that's not an election issue, that's a democracy issue. This is a debate that's going on in the streets of this country and the streets of free countries all over the world that our totalitarian adversaries are using to try to incite division, to incite discord, to take the temperature up based on information that isn't true. And somehow we have to find a way as a free society to respond to that. And it seems to me that the first part of that is to help notify people in real time when this kind of thing is happening, when the country as a whole is subject to this sort of intentional misinformation that we're seeing, frankly, throughout Europe, we've seen it in the most devastating way in Myanmar, where there was people were killed as a result of the content that was being purposely disseminated over social media platforms there. And I think we would be naive to think that that level of political violence couldn't also occur here as well. So I guess the first question I would ask is, what are we going to do about it?
Well, I do think that one aspect of what you do about it is basically expose what the tactics are and what we're seeing, and then address specific issues as they come up, or just as you've been saying. And we have been looking and increasingly working with partners and allies, frankly, around the world to do exactly that, because it is better to do it in numbers, in effect, and to really get the message out in ways that people find increasingly credible in targeting that disinformation. There's also going after, and this is part of, I think, what you were describing, there's going after the sort of the platforms that get used in this context. So, you know, Russia has been pretty extraordinary in terms of the platform that they've built for their work. They essentially have a state-run propaganda machine, right, that is comprised of domestic media apparatus, outlets targeting global audiences such as RT and Sputnik, and a network of kind of quasi-government trolls that are used. And over the years, the apparatus has grown. It's, you know, broadening the array of influence actors, the tactics that they use for covert and deniable operations. And they're trying, as you indicated, to shape U.S. political discourse, European political discourse, to reduce support for Ukraine, other things. And part of what we're seeing is their capacity to use some of the platforms that they've chosen are getting harder as we're getting better at disclosing how those platforms are being used and how countries are taking action to pull broadcasting licenses, other things along those lines, in order to actually make it more challenging. They obviously look for other opportunities and can get around these things, but that is among some of the, you know, sort of opportunities for battling it, I'd say, for others, yeah.
I might just add something to your question insofar as it relates directly to elections. And we have a great relationship with Secretary of State Griswold and Judd Choate, your election director, who are very, very focused on this issue. But if you look at two very powerful examples, again, at the state level, where this may actually happen, one focused on being prepared, the other focused on a very effective response. So in Arizona, Secretary of State Adrian Fontes has been working with his local election officials to do a series of tabletop exercises with deepfakes of him in the day before the election to prepare them to be able to respond and to be able to communicate. And he's brought in local media and the community to help them understand these kinds of threats, and again, to lay the ground to inoculate them from being influenced, because of course those could be amplified by foreign malign influence actors. The other very good example, I think, was the robocall that happened in New Hampshire 2 days before the primary election. When that happened, the Attorney General John Formella came out with a very clear statement saying that it is likely criminal behavior, saying that it's being investigated and that it should be ignored as an example of repression of the vote. And then the Secretary of State, Dave Scanlon, came out. He amplified that on a whole bunch of media platforms to get that message out to all of the constituents, and then said at the end of the day, the turnout was actually higher than he expected. So election officials who are the ones running and securing these elections are out there ensuring that they can prepare. And I think we have good examples of how they're actually able to react to it, sir.
I know. Thank you very much. And thank you both for your testimony. I know I'm out of time, Mr. Chairman, but if I could just finish with one thought. Those are two great examples in Arizona and New Hampshire where local elected officials who have sworn an oath to the Constitution are fulfilling that oath. Director Haynes had good examples of what we're doing with trying to do with foreign actors that are associated with the Kremlin. That's good too. Mr. Chairman, we still have the problem of our own platforms, these platforms in the United States of America, who have not taken the kind of responsibility they need to be able to deal with these challenges as well, who have not kept on the people that they, in theory, hired to do the content moderation work that they were going to do, who have not been willing to think about slowing down the degree to which information is shared across the planet Earth that goes through their network. So I just think we've got a responsibility of our own here in terms of oversight to make sure
we're going doing to, what's required to have, as well. We're going to have that kind of hearing with the social media combination to the ever patient and 7-minute time, Senator Lankford.
I'll take that. Thank you. Thanks, y'all, for your testimony. You were just speaking to Senator Bennett about Russia and some of the influence that they have targeted and the ways that they're doing it. Can we switch sides and actually talk about China? What is China doing currently to try to influence United States public opinion?
If it's all right with you, sir, I'll mention what they're doing here, but also what they're doing abroad, because we're seeing it on a broad range of things. I think they're growing, we assess, really increasingly confident in their ability to influence elections, but remain concerned about the possibility of blowback should they be discovered. And the PRC has made improvements to its influence operation tools using artificial intelligence, big data analytics. Their tactics globally include bankrolling candidates they prefer, using deepfake technologies to generate content, collecting polling data to determine targets for them, conducting social media influence operations. For example, the PLA will take over and operate social media accounts on a number of different platforms. We look to disclose that and tell companies about that when it happens to promote disinformation across the board. And they also target their diasporas. And we've seen them obviously seek to influence elections, not only in the United States in the context of congressional candidates, generally this has been one of the things in a different levels and spaces, but also elections in Taiwan, in Australia, and in Canada. So a pretty significant portion.
How do we expose that? How do we put the word out? Attribution's the challenge here, as we've already talked about already. Once it starts to get out there on social media and other places, how is that exposed most effectively if it's discovered on the federal side?
start, but I think my colleagues may wish to amplify certain aspects of this. I mean, we obviously put in our annual threat assessment some of the things that we're seeing the PRC engage in terms of influence operations, including in these spaces. And when we get intelligence that indicates that the PRC is, for example, taking on social media accounts or things like that in a platform, we then pass that information through. The FBI is able to provide that to the companies to take action.
A general statement, if they're going to do it, is different than a example to say, here's an example of a post that we know was created by or was amplified by China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, whatever it may be. 2016 and 2017, we're able to pull exact examples and to be able to list them, post them, and say, this was Russian created. Here's where it started, here's where it came from, and to be able to expose it. How do we do that now as we're approaching this election and foreign actors are trying to influence?
We will do just that. So essentially the same playbook in that sense that we are identifying specific credible intelligence, we are passing that to the companies or exposing it publicly as the case may determine.
Okay, let me keep going because I'll be limited in time, though I have mercifully 7 minutes to be able to walk through this, but I'll still run out of time on this. Since we passed the Help America's Vote Act, HAVA, as it's all called at this point, there's been perpetual funding that's been sent out to multiple states to be able to improve their systems. It's been interesting. I pulled new numbers because every state says we can't improve our election systems. We don't have enough money on it. So we pulled the recent spending and what people have and what they haven't spent already. Colorado, my colleague Senator Bennett just left, has received $15 million, has only spent 27% of that money. Hawaii has received $8 million and has spent 26% of it. Louisiana has received $14.5 million and has spent zero of that so far. Maryland, $17 million, has spent 37%. Minnesota, $16 million, has spent 41%. Not to leave my own state out, Oklahoma has received $11 million. We've spent 23% of that. Now, other states have spent more on it, but this money has been sitting there for years. This is not money that was allocated in 3 months ago. Quite a bit of this funding was allocated to them years ago, and they have not actually spent it. So my question is, essentially on this, how do we encourage states to be able to up their game on a couple of areas? One is learning the lesson of the unofficial results in their own websites and how to be able to protect those systems. That's an obvious area of creating distrust on election night if those are actually interfered with. The second one is old school paper ballot backups. So if there's a problem with the machine, everybody can verify it with a piece of paper. When we have states that have literally millions of dollars sitting there saying, we don't have enough to be able to do this, when most of them do, how do we advance this?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Senator. So I can't speak to those statistics, and I'm happy to follow up on that. But I will say what we provide as the Sector Risk Management Agency are no-cost services and no-cost training. So many of the states, in fact, thousands of jurisdictions, take advantage of the cybersecurity assessments, the free cyber hygiene scanning we provide, the endpoint detection and response that we have, the malicious domain blocking. So all of that is in place across the country. So I know they're taking advantage of that, and that has significantly raised the bar from a cybersecurity perspective. I think your points about election night reporting are very good ones. One of the things that I think it's really important for everyone to remember is that those are all unofficial results, right? And they need to be canvassed, and you need to be certified, which takes days to weeks.
Right, so, but if it's announced on election night who won, and then a week later, the state announces, oops, no, a different person won, that sows incredible distrust.
I agree.
Where now no one trusts the election results anymore. And while the election results were unofficial, if those are interfered with, that's a real vulnerability to building trust among the American people.
I agree with that, sir. As I said in my opening statement, you know, these systems are more secure than ever before. And election officials, to include Paul Zierex, who's your state election director,
are terrific,
are working incredibly hard to make sure that every one of their citizens' votes are counted as cast. And I think it's really important that we focus on them because they're the true election experts, and we listen to their voices and what they say. And so I would hope that anybody who is providing unofficial results would make sure that that state election director gets a voice in that to say it's not canvassed, it's not certified yet, so let's wait until it's certified.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to ask a follow-up question on this and then have it done. Ms. Knapp, as far as the FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office is following up on a criminal offense of voting, if you're not legally present in the country and you're voting in a federal election, that is a federal crime. What I'd love to be able to know, and I've not been able to get the statistic on, is how many prosecutions do we have across the country for a federal election crime? Is that actually being followed up on? Do we have a good number of both charges being filed and actual prosecutions on that for a federal election crime? I know in my state, we talked about Paul Zirex in my state and what our district attorneys are doing in the state. If someone votes twice or whatever it may be, the prosecution's there and they have a good history on that. I don't know on the federal side. Can y'all provide that to me?
Sir, thank you very much for the question. What I do have in front of me right now is how many cases have been charged through the Department of Justice Task Force on Election Security. What I don't have is that second part, but I can at least give you a general number right now. So right now, the task force has charged 17 cases with a resulting 13 convictions. But with respect to your subset question, I'm happy to take that back to my team and get you a more complete answer.
Great, thank you.
I think those HAVA numbers are pretty remarkable. I'm glad you shared those.
Some states have spent 70, 80% of them. Quite a few of our states have spent 50% or less on the HAVA numbers. And these are the most recent from just a couple of months ago.
That's a very fair question. I do think, and on your question about how many federal violations, I thought there was, something in that range. I thought after the 2000 election, I thought there was a canvas of that had a relatively small number, but I think that might have been both state and federal. Let me move to a slightly that is related to this. As I think, we're talking about AI being all the buzz at this point, but I think the nefarious nature of some of our adversaries of using a series of technology platforms, the independent entities Mandiant and Graphica, both companies that the committee is very familiar with and that we've used, have reported that there are some of these gig employment companies, Freelancer and Fiverr are two that I think their reports indicated, where foreign governments are actually hiring unwittingly citizens in those countries, targeted countries, and then, in effect, paying them to be influence operators. And even more specifically, Cameo, which I think goes after celebrities, depending, I'm not sure whether they're A, B, or C list, but has gone out and appeared to have, again, unwittingly enlisted celebrities to help on anti-Ukraine messaging. How are we thinking as we think about malicious use by foreign actors? A couple years ago, we would not have thought that a gig platform would be a tool for that kind of foreign influence. Anybody on the panel want to take that one?
Or do you want it? Okay, all right, I'll start and we'll play in. But I think, first of all, you're absolutely right. I think one of the key trends that I identified were the use of commercial firms, and some of them are witting and some of them are unwitting in this space. And it's marketing firms, it's public relations firms, it's reputation management firms, it's gig firms, it's across the board. And they're increasingly being relied on to sort of launder covertly directed narratives through media sources and social media platforms. And this complicates, obviously, attribution, and this is something that we're trying to get better at in a faster way. But part of the reason that they're doing this, right, is because these firms tend to be more nimble than their own intelligence services and government apparatus, basically, for taking action. They're also frequently more sophisticated in their capacity to actually promote influence campaigns. And so this is one of the things that we're watching. And in 2020, just to give you a sense of the scale of this, these types of firms, we judge, were involved in information manipulation in at least 48 countries by our count. So it is really becoming increasingly widespread, and it's one of the challenges that we're trying to manage.
But go ahead, Jen.
I would only add, just last month, we actually work with FBI and DNI to put out an advisory that very specifically highlights these tactics to include using proxy media, laundering it through PR, whether witting or unwitting, how to recognize it, and then mitigations around how to actually deal with these types of things. And we're doing separate training on it as well. So part of this is the awareness of it at the election official level, and then what they need to do to mitigate it. Separately, though, the platforms is an issue, obviously, that needs to be addressed directly.
Sir, thank you for the opportunity. We are obviously, like my colleagues, absolutely concerned with any sort of technology that our adversary uses. What I can say in this setting is when we have specific information on a particular company, we will directly engage with them. However, in absence of that, partnering with key partners like CISA and putting out the general awareness piece that allows companies to be more aware and more informed so they can mitigate that and spot it within their own systems.
Well, one of the things I would suggest that this committee and Senator Rubio I think have done fairly effectively was doing a series of classified briefs by industry sector around the challenges of the PRC. This is more specific, but I would hope that the FBI or DOJ might update their FARA, the foreign agent entities that makes all of this activity illegal, that guidance ought to be updated. And I would strongly encourage some level of convening of these kind of platforms. Again, where do you draw the line? But if we have in open source documentation from Graphica and Mandiant the fact that these platforms are being used and citizens are being unwittingly used, now whether the platforms are unwitting or not is maybe an open question, but if they realize that if they were wittingly helping foreign agents interfere, that would be a violation of the law, I think that would be a helpful process. Thoughts on that?
My main thought is one of the really great things since 2020 that's different now, Chairman, is we have the FMIC, which we didn't have before, which allows for those classified briefings, and I'll defer to Avril, but I think that is very much added value.
I'll just say that I very much support the idea of getting the sector together and seeing whether or not we can enhance our capacity to get out to everybody essentially on these issues. So, absolutely.
Yeah. One thing, and I'm going to make sure. Do you want to go again, Mark?
No, you have to go. All right.
One thing I am concerned about, because I appreciate all of these, the comments of the outreach that CIS has done, but, how do we, in appropriately nonpartisan way, I've heard some reports that there are not many, but a certain number of counties that are actually opting out of some of the voluntary tools that CISA has used in the past, like the Einstein system, where I thought for a long time we had literally a level of cyber protection down to county levels. But for whatever reason, certain counties are now opting out of that. I heard in Washington State. Is that kind of a one-off, or I would just hate as we get closer to the election if the distrust of the federal government becomes such that people are literally turning away voluntary cyber and other educational protections.
Yeah, but the good news, Chairman, is that that's not accurate. The trend is actually states and local jurisdictions continue to take advantage of the no-cost voluntary services with respect to the Albert sensors in particular. There's Albert and Einstein, it's easily confused. There's 1,083 sensors across the country. I think less than a handful, less than five, have not renewed their contract. And that's for a variety of reasons, to include opting to use different technology for intrusion detection. So this is something we look at very closely, and I have no concerns. At the end of the day, as you know, Chairman, CISA is a nonpartisan, nonpolitical agency, and we cannot be effective unless we can work with election officials at the state and local level of both parties. So I'm very attuned to that. And I have not seen any significant changes in our ability to provide no-cost services, information, and no-cost voluntary training to election jurisdictions across the nation.
Well, I am, again, turn to Senator Rubio for his closing comments, then I'll make one or two quick comments. The whole system was shocked by 2016. And again, I think a lot of good work by this committee to point out the level of Russian interference, and I still remember at first some of the tech companies refusing to believe it. I think we then took action in 2018. I think, and again, I have repeatedly said, I think under the Trump administration, we were very well prepared in 2020 because there was effective communication and a team that were working well together. I worry at times that in 2024, because of increasing distrust of any governmental entity, I worry in terms of social media platforms that don't seem to even try to have their users adhere to their own standards. These are not government standards, to their own standards. I worry in terms of some of these new AI tools that can operate at speed and scale that's unprecedented. And the fact that we've kind of all become a little bit almost immune to misstatements, mistruths, falsehoods. I share some of the concerns raised by a number of the members, Director Haynes, that we do need a kind of pre-assigned process, especially if we're getting into those last 30 days or last week or so before the election, of who would report. I think this effort today that made the press, it probably is appropriate that the CIA itself responded. But as we get into those final days and weeks, having an approach, and again, citing the 2020 example where, in effect, everyone across the board came out and called out the Iranians for their action, we need to not be game time thinking that through with all of the potential forces that are coming to bear potentially on this election. Senator Rubio?
Good. Just to wrap this all up, first of all, I haven't focused as much on the CISA role because to me the technical aspects, it's not that it's easier technically, you know, protecting elections from people that are professional hackers that are constantly trying to get into everything from water systems to election systems to hospital systems. I mean, these people are, this is what they do all day. So I'm not in any way diminishing, but the importance and the difficulty of it, I am pointing out though that it's technical, right? It's, you know, a red state, a blue state, they're both going to be equally impacted. They both are fertile ground, especially when you get down at the congressional level and even in local elections. So the reason why I focus so much on election interference, influence, and in particular foreign malign influence is because that's a lot trickier. And just the threats, I don't know where this comes from. I think it's the assessment for foreign threats to 22, if you just go through this, you start to see one of the first things that it points out, which I think you see to this day, is that, you know, part of their effort is largely, some of these operators are largely focused on amplifying what are already authentic beliefs in American politics, right? So these are people already believe these things, and one of the things they do is they just simply amplify things that people are already saying. So what's the risk there? If you say that the Iranians or the Russians or the Chinese are amplifying a message, some people take that to mean if I believe in something that I've stood for a long time, all of a sudden now I'm a Chinese agent or now I'm a Russian agent because I'm actually saying things on the campaign trail. And so you see it, for example, and it's also, you know, the Iran proposed helping nationalist groups inside the U.S. and Iranian officials advocated using covert social media to pit the extremist groups against each other, though more likely for use in 2024. This was written in 22. So obviously we're now in 24 and you see that. So that's just an effort to get Americans to fight and make us look weak internally. Then the other thing is that in October of 22, Twitter exposed three separate Iranian-based influence networks operating on the platform, generally supporting left-leaning U.S. politicians, including a range of House and Senate candidates. And according to industry reports, many exposed accounts espoused pro-Palestinian sentiments at the same time they expressed positive sentiments towards progressive candidates. Now you flip to the Russians. The Russians tried to denigrate the Democratic Party before the midterm and undermine confidence in the election, most likely to weaken U.S. support for Ukraine. So they denigrated the Democratic Party. They wanted, in particular, they amplified questions about whether U.S. aid to Ukraine would continue if the balance of power in Congress shifted. Their intent there is not that they're Democrat, that they're Republicans, but their intent there was to denigrate the Democratic Party because it furthered their aim. And in the process, also begin to influence our willingness to continue to be committed to helping Ukraine. you move on to others. So another one that the Russians, blaming multiculturalism and leftist ideals for ostensibly driving the U.S. into a crisis. There are a lot of people that actually hold that view, irrespective of what the Russians believe. They're just amplifying what somebody's probably been saying for 15 years. That doesn't make that person a Russian agent. It just makes it more difficult on this. And then there you have these unique cases, and this one in particular strikes home because I think I know who you're talking about. They're talking about, we assessed that Cuba attempted to undermine the electoral process of specific U.S. congressional politicians in 2022 that they perceive as hostile. They focused their operations aimed at denigrating specific U.S. candidates in Florida, although in an attempt to shape the impression of other politicians as well, because they view Cuban Americans in Miami as having an outsized influence on U.S. policy with regards to Cuba. So, and they also cultivated members of the U.S. media who held critical views of that member of Congress. So, I probably know who they're talking about, but the point in it, you know, obviously it was in 22, so where I happen to be on the ballot, among others. But the point being is that that's a very specific aim. My whole point in all of this is you have the example that I've used about the fake AI video, okay? And that's almost, I don't say it's an easy question, but that's a more obvious one. It's clearly a fake video, and I think what we want to know is, do we have a formalized process to act very quickly to say, this thing is fake, even if we can't attribute it? You don't need to attribute it to be able, in the last days of a campaign, to at least protect the American people. And it has to be done in a way where the other side, who maybe hopes it's real, doesn't feel like you're tipping the scales in favor of your preferred candidate, right? To be blunt, let's say a video comes out that's fake about Trump, and the DNI comes out and says, this video is, it's not a fake, or let me do the reverse. Somebody comes, a video that comes out about Biden, and the DNI, yourself, or whoever's in, you know, in charge of coming out with this says, this video is a fake. I can see where people on the Trump side would say, well, that's just because you're trying to help Biden. It's probably a real video. And the reverse would be true in a different scenario. So it's a hard thing to do, but someone has to be in charge of coming forward and at least saying it's fake, even if we can't attribute it. That's the obvious questions. This one, the one I've just described about amplifying voices that are already out there in narratives, that's a lot tougher. I think the most we can say in that regard is, look, we know that these countries are doing this. They're not doing it because they're Democrats or Republican. It serves some purpose, influencing Cuba policy, influencing Ukraine policy, make America look chaotic, get groups to fight against each other. But this is what they're doing, and let people make judgments as to how they take these narratives. It's tough. I don't have an easy answer for how we fix it or what the process should look like in terms of notifying people. I just know that this is going to get far more complex. And I predict it won't just be about elections. It will actually become in real time, it already is, on policy debates that we're having here. Should we have tariffs? Should we ban TikTok? Should we, you name it, on a weekly basis, whatever the issue is here, I can see this becoming part of the an influence even in our daily political debates. So we really need to get a handle on it. It's a tough one, but we really need to because it's gonna get far worse, far more sophisticated with far more, many more players. And I think pose a grave danger at some point of turning into something that we haven't fully anticipated. So I hope we can continue to work on finding a way forward because this, I'm sure they'll be talking about it at this dais after we're both gone. This will still be a factor. Thank you.
I agree with Senator Rubio. I think these are challenged, but I think the only thing that I would hope we both agree on is that, yeah, Americans have got plenty of differences between each. But if that amplification can literally be traced back to the Cuban spy services, and it is appearing that millions of Floridians are saying something that they're not really saying, I think the Floridians ought to know that that is not the case, that we can trace it back to the Cuban services, or we can trace it back that these individuals who are posting things anti-Ukraine are actually being paid by Russia. If that proof is there, some of these things would violate why I think the upgrading of the FARA bill, there are restrictions against foreign agents taking these kind of actions. So it is a challenge. Technology is going to make it much, much harder. This will not be the last time that we deal with this. And please, for all of the folks who are in the row supporting you and, more importantly, back at your respective agencies, we're going to count on you. This truly is, we always say, politicians always say, particularly when they're up, this is the most important election ever. Even though neither one of us are up this time, this is the most important election ever. We're adjourned.